Underworld, Disc 7.
Chapter 5. When people tell rat stories, the rat is always tremendous. It's a drag-belly rat the size of a cat, because this is a satisfying rhyme. There was a fair amount of rat lore in these streets when Nick Shea was growing up. Not that rats were frequently seen. They were heard on the walls and down the yards, indelible half-fictions, running across rooftops in the moon. Enormous rats with rat-brown fur. There were rats in sewers and demolition sites and coal bins, a rustling in the flung garbage of empty lots. He got out of a taxi near the building where his mother lived. The building wasn't here 30-40 years ago. A large brown structure, tall and broad, and defined by a sense of fortification. Fences and ramps, cameras angled from the brickwork. This used to be a row of 5-story buildings, tenements. And that's where he saw the rat, wet and dead, lying next to a coal pile on the sidewalk. He was 9 or 10 at the time, and the incident came back to him, taxi easing from the curb with a detailed directness. Just a dead rat, but he could see it clearly, feeling a kind of doubleness, a shaped transparency, die-cut, that fit him to the moment. He remembered how he'd studied the limp body, feeling a grisly thrill to be so close, able to trace a faint pink line down the underside of the tail. And the rat was brown and gray and pink and white all together and separate. But he was disappointed by its size. He would have to exaggerate the rat, put some heft and length in his story, some mouth drool and yellow eye. There was a man in a plexiglass booth. Nick signed a register and was buzzed into the lobby, which was occupied by kids, small and smaller, playing, milling, their voices shrieky in the bare space. He took the elevator to 12. The other rat was later, when he was in his 20s, also ordinary in size, your common Norway brown. But ordinary is big enough when you talk about rats. Matt opened the door. His brother Matty, still looking a little boyish, short and blocky, cowlicked, with thick glasses and a fresh haircut, and some gray, maybe, on top that seemed extraneous. Mid-40s, he would be. They hadn't seen each other in a few years, and it was only an accident of timing that brought them together today. They shook hands and exchanged the wry smile of adversaries who are enjoined from mauling each other by some inconvenience of context. Nick said, "Where is she?" They talked about their mother, about medications, doctor's appointments, not unusual matters. But there was a rigor in the older brother's questions, a particularity of interest and concern that amounted to a kind of challenge. Matt said finally, "She's okay. She's good. She eats and sleeps normally." "You want to know about her natural functions, you'll have to ask her yourself." "You're staying over?"
2 nights.
"You've totally forgotten what it's like, Nick. A night in the Bronx." But Matty had long since filled out the small boy's sketchy torso, developed some mass in his upper body, a certain sturdiness of bearing. Nick said, "I have to go to Jersey in the morning or I take her to the doctor myself."
"What's in Jersey? Chemical waste eating people's houses?"
"Personal business."
"How's Marion?"
"Fine. They're all fine." They drank seltzer and took turns looking out the window. There was a picture window with a broad view west. El Bronx. People sat on lawn chairs on the roof of a motel nearby. Nick could tell these were local men and women who'd gained entry to the roof from an adjacent building, carrying their chairs and newspapers. He knew it was evidence of brisk improvisation, people extracting pleasure from the grudging streets. But it made him nervous. It was a breach, another opening, another local sign of instability and risk.
I took her to the zoo, Matt said. She has the zoo across the street, but it's the first time in 20 years I could get her to go. Practically forced her out the door.
You're on a mission.
She says she has more animals on television than she can handle. I can't make her see the point of living, breathing creatures.
I'm getting her out of here, Nick said.
Is that right?
To Phoenix, that's right. There's no reason anymore for her to be here.
She has friends here. You know this.
I know this? How many friends? What friends?
To Phoenix, Matt said.
How many friends?
We haven't done a head count lately, but if she wanted to go, we'd take her gladly.
You don't have room.
We have room, Matt said.
Listen to me. You don't have room. We have room. We also have climate.
Climate?
This is important at her age.
Janet's a nurse. You want to make a contest out of it? Janet's a nurse.
This is stupid.
Of course it's stupid. This is why we're doing it, Matt said.
Nick was at the window again. Why would they put a motel in a place like this?
I don't know.
It's a convenience, this motel, for sex and drugs. Because what else is it here for? Or homeless, a shelter for homeless people. They put them in motels now.
She likes it here, Nick. It's her life. It's what she's used to. She has her church, her stores, all the familiar things. And the friends that are still alive. Ask her for a list.
You don't know. I know. It's a convenience, this motel, for what they're doing. Nick went into the kitchen and started opening cabinets. He inspected the area under the sink. Kids were riding tricycles in the hallway. He poured another seltzer and went into the living room. The bike bells sounded down the hall.
How's Janet? Janet's all right? She had a lump removed from under her arm.
Did I know this?
It's okay. She's doing okay. The kids are okay.
These lumps are everywhere. Everybody's looking for lumps.
I read something in a paper not long ago. Made me think of you, Matt said. Remember those machines they had in the shoe stores? Tall consoles, sort of like old radios, but with a slot down near the bottom?
Jesus, yes. I haven't thought of that.
The clerk puts shoes on the kid's feet, and then the kid goes and stands with his feet inside the slot.
I haven't thought of that since I was... what?
They stopped making them. And the clerk looks into the viewer at the top of the device and can see the feet inside the shoes.
To check the fit, Nick said.
To check the fit. Well, the machine was a fluoroscope, and what it did was transmit X-rays through the shoe and into the foot. It's called differential transmission, and it makes a shadowy, greenish image. I just barely remember this. Jimmy's buying you a pair of shoes, and then he's lifting me up so I can look into the machine and see your feet inside your shoes and your bones inside your feet.
The question is, where are those shoes now?
No, the question is, did you do this enough times to suffer bone damage? Because the machine was basically spraying your feet with radiation.
They heard the key in the lock. I have healthy feet, Nick said.
I'm relieved.
But thanks for the scare. I'll do the same for you someday. Rosemary Shea came through the door with a shopping bag in each hand. Her body slanted toward the heavier bag. She saw that Nick was here. She stood and looked at him, eyes alive and searching. She was always searching him for something, some sign, some change. He moved toward her to help with the bags. Her face had furrows nearly everywhere, gathers and tucks, little parchment pleats above the mouth. Her hands were old. They were long and worked, milky blue veins lapping the scored knuckles. They took the bags away from her, complaining that she didn't allow them to help her sufficiently. They warned of back strain and heat exhaustion. She told them to shut up, even as she tried to take the groceries away, items passing hand to hand. Nick embraced her, laughing, and she felt unpersuadable in his arms. They ate and talked, took second helpings, corn on the cob, enormous tomatoes the grocer kept in the back room for special customers, grown in his yard on City Island. The old, deep tomato taste, summery and blood-buttery and voluptuous.
"Tell him about the job," Rosemary said.
"He doesn't want to know. He's your brother. Tell him."
"Another job change?" Nick said.
"Yes. A research institute."
"Then this is not a change."
"A different one. Non-profit. We draw up studies to help third-world countries develop health services and banking facilities."
"Goody-goody stuff."
"Yes," Matt said happily. "We produce paper. We smoke pipes, those of us who smoke."
"A think tank,"
Rosemary said. They let this term hover above the salad. Year by year, job by job, Matt was separating himself from the science he did in the 1970s. Work whose precise nature eluded Nick. Government work that involved classified projects and remote locations. Not that Nick was eager to reach him. It was strange, that's all, for younger brother to be the tight-lipped guy for a change, not inclined to answer questions readily.
"My kid's learning the game. Jeffrey."
"What game?"
Matt said.
"What game? What game would I be talking about? Your game."
"My game."
"He plays against his computer. His computer has a chess program with a take-back option, so he can undo his dumber moves."
Matt said nothing. The cats came out of hiding. They curled around the chair legs, hooked their backs, rubbing against the legs of the people, undulant in the mazy space down there. And they went sway-backed and yawned, asses up.
"We have room for you," Nick said to his mother.
"Where did this come from?"
"It was always here, you know that. We've been waiting for you to say you're ready."
"Well, I'm not." "We have dessert. Who wants coffee?" she said. "I have the decaf. I know Maddie takes it."
Then she told him a story about Jimmy downtown. She told it over coffee, and they listened with a shared intensity that no other subject could remotely provoke. It was the thing that made them a family still, after all the silences and distances, the father, in his lost glory, making book.
"It was a funny thing. Funny strange, I mean, but the first bets he ever took were from cops. He was a plumber's helper at the New Yorker Hotel. Then he was moved into the security office, which I visited several times. We were keeping company then. A big, noisy office in the freight delivery area. And the security chief had made a space for the local bookmaker to come and do his tally every morning. He charged him rent. Very reasonable, I'm sure. Soon the bookie makes Jimmy his runner. Jimmy loved this. He made payoffs to winners. He collected money from losers. He did the rounds every day. All through the garment district, this was. He was light on his feet, dodging the boys who pushed the racks. He started picking up extra action. Action for himself. Sitting on bets, it was called. He selected carefully, a bet here and there. And it was often the police he was getting his business from. So you have the security people, and the police, and what else is new? Then once a month, a detective, this is the bagman, he went to the Solomon Brothers car dealer, and he picked up the protection money to distribute in the precinct house. So the money's flowing back and forth, and everybody's happy. The Solomon Brothers ran the bookie operation for the whole area. Arthur and, I forget the other Solomon, Arthur and Bernie. And Arthur and Bernie wore beautiful suits and had a box at the polo grounds and new ball players and show people. And eventually Jimmy got his own small piece of the action. On the up and up. And the Solomons paid him $80 a week. This is after you were born, she said to Nick. And after he already left me once. Plus a bonus for a good business month.
Matt said, but who kept other gambling interests from moving in? A couple of car dealers couldn't do that, could they? They must have imported real gangsters.
They didn't have to. The money they paid the police was double coverage money. They paid the police to let them operate, and they also paid them to rouse the competition. When competition showed up, the borough detectives or precinct detectives came down on them like a holy terror.
Gangbusters, Matt said.
Like gangbusters. Which is the story I started out to tell before I got involved in the fine print. The police making arrests. They even had to arrest the bookies who were paying them off. They got pressure when people complained. Upstanding citizens, you know, or straight from City Hall. These were called accommodation arrests. The sergeant would apologize. He would book you at the precinct on 30th Street. And then you went to Center Street, where the lawyer for the Solomons was waiting, and you said, "Guilty, Judge," and paid a $25 fine and went back to work. "And the day you were born," she said to Matt, "your father was arrested twice. Confusion inside the precinct. They arrested him in the morning, and when he finally got released, he took the subway to the Bronx, where I was in the hospital getting ready to deliver. It was one of those steamy, sticky days, and he came in the room and mopped my brow and fanned me with a racing form and said, 'Did you have it yet?' And after a while he said he has to see a man. Very important. Be right back. And he went downtown and got arrested again. Different cop. Same desk sergeant. I don't know about the judge. And when he got back to the hospital, with the running around and the heat and the subway, he looked worse off than I did. But he got no sympathy, you can believe it, from me." Matt said, "Interesting day. It was a dizzy comedy. But we had no one to share it with, because it was one thing to take bets, but not so acceptable to get arrested for it. And I've never told this story until now."
Nick watched her carefully, absorbing every gesture and expression. A depth in her eyes that she dared her sons to interpret. The gnaw, the rankling pain that sits inside the good-natured telling. And the voice in its factual carry, vowels extended and bent a bit. A sound out of the old streets. The old demotic song, gone to the near suburbs now. And a slight Irish pitch teasing the piece from somewhere deep in childhood. There was a noise in the street. A customized car speaker bombing the night with music. A car that was all sound. A mobile sound bomb. And Nick glanced sharply at his brother, who shrugged and grinned.
"He wants you to sit on his patio, Mama. Bright stars above, cactus outlined in the moonlight."
Imagine me in cactus. No noise in the street. They arrest people for noise out there. If your front yard isn't neat and clean, your neighbor's kids won't talk to your kids. Nick waited for her to speak again. He opened himself to everything inside her, to the past that never stops happening, and the passing minute, and what she feels when she scratches the back of her hand, pulling at the skin, then scratching. He tried to hear the rustle of her life, the fly buzzing in the room of the woman who lives alone. One of the cats rubbed against his ankle, the orange Tom his mother had found in the street. He shook it off and poured coffee all around. They sat at the table talking in low tones. Rosemary was in the bedroom, and they talked across the dishes and cups and the flick of spilt milk. "Where do you sleep?"
"I make up the sofa," Matt said.
"Where do you sleep?" "Park Avenue South, the Doral." "You drove down?"
"Took the shuttle."
"Tell me, in all seriousness, do you really want to take her out of there?" "More than ever."
"You have to understand, this woman is not afraid. She lives a free life. People know her, they respect her. The neighborhood's still a living thing."
"Lower your voice."
"Lower my voice."
"Did you see the hallways?" Nick said. "The hallways.
These hallways? Which hallways?"
Matt stacked some dishes and took them to the kitchen. "Listen to me. Stand at the elevator, look to your left, then look to your right. What do you see?"
"I don't know. What do I see?"
"You see the longest, saddest, scariest, most depressing... that feeling, you know?"
"It's a hallway," Matt said.
"It's that feeling... a nightmare out of some Stalinist..." "All right, I'm overreacting." It's a hallway. Filled, as a matter of fact, with little kids most of the time.
Lower your voice. Look, it is well within your experience to invent a fantasy of events as you think they transpired or are transpiring. This is not un-up your alley.
Nick couldn't look at his brother without wanting to pop him a shot across the mouth. Same reason as ever. The father, not the mother. The deep discordance, the old muscling of wills, that ungiving thing in the idea of brothers.
No one came for him, Nicky. No one got him and took him away. He left because of us, basically. He didn't want to be a father. Being a husband was bad enough. What a burden, you know, full of obligations and occasions he couldn't handle. He was a loner, to use the romantic word. Only worse than that, clinically self-involved. Not out of vanity or stupidity, but out of some fear, some inbred perspective, some closeness of perspective that amounted to fear. It made him unable to see other people except as encumbrances, little hazy shapes that interfered with his solitude, his hardness of being. He should have joined the French Foreign Legion when he was 20. Not that I'm ready to renounce my existence, but speaking honestly and realistically, that's what he should have done.
You know a lot. How do you know so much?
She tells me things. She tells me things she never told you.
I'm looking at you saying this.
You're looking at me.
That's right. You're giving me the look. That's right, I am. Matt was at the sink doing dishes now, running the tap at low volume so they could hear each other, and he didn't turn to check his brother's look.
He had some trouble. Some sharpshooter hit a long shot on him. A big bet at long odds. Jimmy had his own operation by then, independent of the Solomons. I even know the horse's name.
You know a lot. How come I'm not impressed?
It was the final weight, the final pressure, and it pushed him out the door.
Listen to me. I'm confused here. Help me out. First he leaves because of us. Then he leaves because somebody hits a long shot and he can't pay off.
Terra firma. Jimmy hadn't laid off the bet with bookies who could handle those sums. Maybe it was a late bet, and he didn't have time to shop it around.
You know this, and I don't?
She protects you.
I am completely fucking unimpressed. Why is that?
There was no drama of men pushing him into a car and speeding away. He owed money he couldn't pay. He was a small operator. He paid a button maker $10 a week to help figure out his tally. He dealt in small numbers.
Listen to me. This is not an invitation to violence. When you owe money to someone and can't pay off, in that environment?
What environment? You heard her. They didn't need enforcers.
No, they had cops, but not for this kind of situation.
He left before a situation could develop. He had one foot out the door for years. You heard her. He left her once before. He was looking for an excuse to make it permanent.
You know all this, and I don't. And yet I'm remarkably unimpressed. Help me out. Explain this to me.
Matt turned off the tap and looked at his brother, who sat leaning over the table. He did the unthinkable Italian crime. He walked out on his family. They don't even have a name for this.
He didn't walk out. They came and got him.
Keep believing it, Matt said.
He turned on the tap, sponging and rinsing the dishes. The car came back, the car-sized boombox, causing a fuzz storm out there. Nick leaned heavily over the table, lazy-eyed now, brows lowered and mouth open just a chink, forming a lifeless grin. He resembled a man who'd started out drinking hours ago, determined to reach a point of particular abandon. No one spoke. Matt washed and dried a dish, then tried to find the place in the cabinet where it belonged. The car moved off now, finally. Then Nick got up. He took the remaining objects from the table and carried them into the kitchen area. He didn't walk, he moved. It was heavy movement, sluggish and brooding.
She has her church, Matt said. What?
She has her church, her priest.
We'll get her a new church.
It won't be the same.
We don't want it to be the same. We want it to be different. That's the point.
Matt handed him a glass to dry. They worked quietly for a time, doing the dishes and putting them away, finding the right place for each item.
How's the waste business?
Booming.
The waste business, bigger by the minute.
I bet it is.
We can't build enough landfills, dig enough gaping caverns.
You get in there? See the stuff up close?
I drive by sometimes, inspect from a distance.
You smell the smell?
I've done this, yes.
You see the rats? It must be the planet of the rats.
Nick found a place in the cabinet for dessert dishes.
Did I ever tell you about the rat downtown?
I don't think so, Matt said.
I was thinking about it coming up here. I had a date, a jazz date. We went to see Charles Mingus.
I'm trying to think. I think I was living in Palo Alto then, doing textbook work. Came back for a conference. Maybe I was 26. And my date was a German woman, a philosophy student. Yes, and the sort of future, now that I think of it, terrorist type. And we went to see Mingus on Hudson Street somewhere. And Mingus stood up there rocking his bass and glaring down at the cash register every time it rang. Mingus was big, and he was wide. He looked like three men sharing a suit. And I walked her home. We walked way across town, and then downtown. And we get to her place, a basement apartment in an old building. And we walk in the door. The second we walk in the door, she turns on the light, and then this rat. I'm standing there thinking whatever I'm thinking. Sex is not external to these thoughts. And then this rat. I see this rat go right up the wall. It runs up the wall. A very tremendous rat. And it makes a sound I can still hear. Like a whistling corpse. And my date says something in German, and picks up something from a table and goes after the rat. I stand there dead still. I'm immobilized by frozen desire. My desire has frozen in my loins. And my date is charging across the room after the rat. Matt placed a wet cup in the dish towel that Nick held in his hand. Nick could see the pleasure of the kid brother who was invited into the action, given the privileged details of some infamous event. All the more dimensional, the rarer and sweeter when the narrator allows an element of foolery to attach itself to his sober persona, some haplessness or slippery shame, all the more intimate and appealing. And the rat runs down the other side of the wall and goes zip into the bathroom like a toy on a string, only 1,000 times quicker. A phenomenal rat, big and fast, and my date goes right after it, wielding whatever she was wielding that I never actually identified. She turns on the bathroom light and goes right in. I'm feeling, frankly, a little neglected, but never mind. I stay where I am. I think, what is happening to my jazz date? It's disintegrating into a rat hunt. And then she sticks her head out the door. Matt studied his brother's face, perceptibly moving his lips to Nick's account, anticipating a word, changing expression when Nick did.
I am standing as far from the bathroom door as I can stand and still be said to occupy the apartment. I have the front door open. My date is battling the rat in the bathroom, and I can hear the rat's sick whistle. And my date sticks her head out the door and says, I am not believing this. I am killing this fucking rat 2 times already. Rat poison with skulls, and now it's coming back. And she goes back in and resumes the hunt. And I feel totally unworthy. Sleep with her. I have no right being in the same city. I can hear the rat running across the bathtub. Did you ever hear a rat run across a tub? I'll tell you, man, it's awesome.
Matt was strangling with pleasure.
He made a sound in his throat, an involuntary quaver.
Nick finished the story. The rat squeezing neatly through a vent in the wall. The evening completely queered. They drank another cup of coffee, and then his brother found the phone book and called a cab. Nick stood by the window in the living room.
He was looking for hookers in spandex tights on the motel roof.
The Italians. They sat on the stoop with paper fans and orangeades. They made their world. They said, "Who's better than me?" She could never say that. They knew how to sit there and say that and be happy. Thinking back through the decades, she saw a woman fanning herself with a magazine, and it seemed like an encyclopedia of breezes, the book of all the breezes that ever blew. The city drugged with heat, horses perishing in the streets. Who's better than me? She heard them talking out there. He wants me to go to the zoo because the animals are real. I told him these are zoo animals. These are animals that live in the Bronx. On television, I can see animals in the rainforest or the desert. So which is real and which is fake? Which made him laugh. It would have been easier to believe she deserved it. He left because she was heartless, foolish, angry. She was a bad housekeeper, a bad mother, a cold woman. But she could not invent a reliable plot for any of these excuses. But it was the sweetest intimacy. His whispered stories of the gamblers and the police, lying in bed, the two of them. His days with the garment bosses and bellhops. He made her laugh, telling these stories late at night, love nights, whispering to her afterward, lying close in bed. And even when he was flat pocket broke, he told her funny, screwy stories in the night. She began to drift into sleep now, and said a Hail Mary, because this is what she always did before she went to sleep. Except she wasn't always sure anymore whether the last Hail Mary she said was a Hail Mary from last night or from 2 minutes ago. And she said this prayer and said this prayer because she mixed up the time and didn't want to go to sleep without being sure. She had more material things than most people she knew, thanks to sons who provided. She had nicer furniture, a safer building, doctors left and right. They made her go to a gynecologist, with Janet calling and then Marion calling. Women of the world, hooray! But she still couldn't say, "Who's better than me?" She got the Italian without the family. The boy who just showed up like a shadow off a wall. She didn't mind that at first. She liked it. She didn't want relatives turning up with pastry and white boxes. She liked his slimness, his lack of attachments. But then she began to see what this meant. The only thing preserved in the man's dark body was a kid in empty space, the shifty boy on the verge of using up his luck. Then she slept. And then the car music woke her up. She heard their voices again, the cupboard doors shutting. She did not show her love. She showed it, but not enough. She was not good at that. But it was partly his doing. The more she loved him, the scareder he got. He was scared in his eyes, telling funny stories in the night. She heard them opening and shutting the cupboard doors. They'd never known where things belonged. Why should they know now? Jerks. She scratched the back of her hand fiercely and said another Hail Mary in case the last one she said was last night. This is how she was brought up. Go to Mass, mind your parents, marry the hard-working boy, the ordinary boy, the ham and egger, they used to say. And the nuns used to say, "You're a child of Mary, and you don't have to kiss him." But he wasn't ordinary, and she kissed him. She couldn't bear to think that Nick might be right. Someone came and got him. This would make her Jimmy innocent, which Nick believed from an early age. But maybe the other was worse. The truth was worse. It did not happen violent. She slept and then woke up. She listened and knew that Nick had left and Maddie had gone to bed. And then she listened for noises on the street and she thought of the animals in their cages and habitats. Lions near Boston Road, coughing in the night.
They were showing the videotape again, but Nick wasn't watching. He stood by the window in his hotel, looking at cars move soundlessly on the avenue, sparse traffic in the sodium glow of the street lamps. He was waiting for room service to show up with his brandy. On the trip down here, the cabbie had driven left-handed all the way, a Dominican in a net shirt, his right arm extended across the seat back. He told Nick about the murders of gypsy drivers, a regular event lately, a game of chance you play every night. Nick didn't like cats. Once he got her to say yes, the cats would have to be sent into retirement.
Either they rob you and kill you, or they rob you and let you live. Or you take them somewhere very efficient, the man said, and either they pay you or they don't.
I live a quiet life in an unassuming house in a suburb of Phoenix. Once he got her to say yes, they'd be able to spend untrammeled time remembering together. He had tipped the man nicely. What do you tip a man who risks his life when he answers a call? Nick was confident he'd tipped him nicely, handsomely, but not ridiculously, not in a way that would have exposed him as a stranger here. He looked at the TV screen, where the tape was nearing the point when the driver waves, the crisp wave from the top of the steering wheel, and he waited for room service to knock on the door. Chapter 6. When Maddie was real small, and his brother used to sit on the pot and read comics to a peewee audience, neighbor kids, ages 4 and 5, supposedly being minded by a grown-up somewhere near, with Maddie in the doorway, ready to shout out, "Chicky," which was the warning word, and there's Nick on the pot reading to them from Captain Marvel or the Targeteers, his pants hanging limp from his kneecaps. And he did lively dialogue, declaimed and gestured, developed a voice for villains and for women, and an airy, stabbing screech for gangster cars cornering tightly in the night, scaring the kids at times with his intensity of manner, then pausing to loose a turd that would splattingly drop. That would plop into the water, the funniest sound in nature, sending a happy awe across the faces of his listeners. It was the creepiest delight of all. Better than anything he might deliver from the paneled pages. Matt walked through the neighborhood to see the old building, number 611, and wondered idly who lived in their third-floor apartment, what language spoken, how many grinding lives. But mainly he thought of 9-year-old Nicky asquat the glory seat. Who else would read the comic books to them, acting out those vibrant dramas of crime fiends and bounding heroes? He went to see Bronzini, his old chess mentor, a sweet-natured man and not-so-willing drillmaster. Living now in a sad building with an entranceway marked by specimens of urban spoor, spray paint, piss, saliva, dapples of dark stuff that was probably blood. The elevator wasn't working, and Matt made his way up 5 flights, a child's sandal on the landing. He knocked and waited. He sensed an eyeball on the other side of the peephole, and he thought of his own street and house and the life of the computer suburb, those huddled enclaves off the turnpike, situated to discourage entry, and the corner store that sells 11 kinds of croissants and 27 coffees, which are somehow never enough, and the life he led before this, the weapons he studied and helped perfect, the desert experience, so completely unconnected to root reality, compared to this man, he thought, on the other side of the peephole, who watches the ruin build around him on the actual planet where he was born. The man's smile was in his eyes, a warm fizz that had an eagerness in it, a desire to know. This is what remained, his curiosity. He looked too old, too spare, his face a boxy outline, an underdrawing of the original likeness, the fleshed-out and tinted-in Bronzini. A couple of days of gray stubble surrounded his untrimmed mustache, and Matt thought the man had seized upon old age, embraced it with a kind of reckless assent. Please, no misters. It's Albert now. And you look well, robust. I'm surprised. I remember a matchstick with a fiery head.
Evidently the man had forgotten more recent meetings. They sat at a table near the window and drank brewed tea. Bronzini lived with his sister now, who'd never married, who sat in a room and spoke in chants, he said, of reduced informational range. Such compression. But once he'd learned to be patient with her repetitions and attenuations, he began to find her presence a source of enormous comfort. A rest, he said, from his own internal rant. He said, "Sometimes I take the train downtown. There's a chess club that's also a coffee house in the village, and I play a game or two. I lose, but I don't get embarrassed. Or I play down there on the playground with a neighbor. We share a bench. They leave us alone, the kids."
"I don't play," Matt said, in a voice emptied of any shading.
"I used to wonder about your father. He taught you the moves, but was he a serious player, I used to wonder. I didn't know him well enough to bring up the subject. Any subject. He was not a man who encouraged, shall we say, inquiries."
The eyes fizzled like carbonated water.
"He taught me quite a bit. We practiced openings and played many games. We played speed chess for fun. He called it rapid transit."
When his father went out for cigarettes, Matty was finishing first grade. He found a book of chess problems Jimmy had kept in a bureau. It was a major discovery, and he worked his way through the book and sat in front of the board, squares and pieces, pushing wood. His brother used to walk into the room and knock the pieces off the board and walk out of the room without a word. Matty picked up the pieces and set them on the board exactly as positioned earlier. He'd studied Black's defense. His brother would walk into the room, knock the pieces off the board, and walk out again.
"Your mother petitioned me, but you were a problem," Bronzini said. "I needed help to deal with you."
"Hard to handle?"
"Volatile, yes, and very quick to dismiss my advice. Of course, you saw things I did not. You had remarkable skills and insights. It was exhilarating for me, but also humbling. I lacked the deep feel of a master player."
"As a team, we were maybe a little shaky, but we managed to last a few years. We tasted a little glory, Albert. I can tell you, I don't like that little boy. I don't like thinking about him."
"I study theory now and then. I read a little in the history of the game, the personality of the game. This is a game of enormous hostility."
"I came to hate the language," Matt said. "You crush your opponent. It's not a question of win or lose. You crush him. You annihilate him. You strip him of dignity, manhood, womanhood. You destroy him. You expose him publicly as an inferior being. And then you gloat in his face. All the things that gave me such naked pleasure, I began to hate."
"Because you began to lose," Albert said.
It was true, of course, and Matt laughed. All that concentrated power, the implosive life of the board, black and white, the autocratic beauty of winning. What a chestful of undisguisable pride. He defeated men, boys, the old and wise, the vigorous and quick, the bohemian cafe poets, friendly and smelly. But then at 10 or 11, he saw his edge begin to muddy, and he took some losses, suffered consistent reversals that made him sick and limp.
"The competition changed. We found better opponents for you to play."
"And I slowed down."
"Your development hit a wall. Not a wall, but it no longer grew exponentially."
Matt looked out at the playground, surprised at the desolation. The basketball court potholed and empty, only one backboard still standing. Directly below him, the old bocce court, grown over with weeds. Everything empty. Up on the second level, the softball field empty and tar-hot, a heavy, sweltery indolence,
the dark surface flashing with broken glass. Two or three men, he sees them now, standing out near the left field fence, sort of mortally posed like figures in spaghetti westerns, lean, nameless, unshaved. He didn't think they were acquainted with the language of life expectancy. He said, "I've been walking around. It's a complicated thing. I find myself trying to resist the standard response."
"You don't want to be shocked. You're reluctant to blame anyone. But you went to the old streets?"
"Yes."
"You saw your building. The squalor around it. The empty lot with a razor wire."
"Yes."
"The men. Who are they, standing around doing nothing?" "Poor people. They're very shocking."
"Yes, they are," Matt said.
"And these were your streets? It's a curious rite of passage, isn't it? Visit the old places. First you wonder how you lived so uncomplainingly in such cramped circumstances. The streets are narrower, the buildings smaller than you ever remembered. It's like coming back to Lilliput. And think of the rooms. Think of the tiny bathrooms shared by the family, by the grandparents, by the uncle who's slightly upats. And what else do you see? These people that you barely glance at. How can you see them clearly? You can't."
"No, I can't."
"And you want to ask me why I'm still here? I see your mother in the market and we talk about this. We want nothing to do with this business of mourning the old streets. We've made our choice. We complain, but we don't mourn. We don't grieve. There are things here, people who show the highest human qualities, outside all notice, because who comes here to see? And I'm too rooted to leave. Speaking only for myself, I'm too rooted, too narrow. My mind is open to absolutely anything, but my life is not. I don't want to adjust. I'm an old Roman Stoic. Not then. I was always too old, too narrow. Clara used to attack me on the subject. Not attack me, chide me. Urge me to see things differently."
"Do you talk to her at all?"
"No. Go to Arthur Avenue, Matty. Look at the shops and the people shopping and the people weighing the fish and cutting the meat. This'll restore your spirits. I took your mother into the pork store the other day to show her the ceiling. Hundreds of hanging salamis. Such bounty and fullness. A place teeming with smells and textures. The ceiling covered completely. I said, 'Rosemary, look, a Gothic cathedral of pork.'"
They shook hands at the door. "You used to wear glasses, Albert."
"I didn't absolutely need them. I needed them a little. They were part of my schoolteacher's paraphernalia, my accoutrement. Take the elevator."
"It's not working."
"It's not working. Then I guess you'll have to walk. But don't tarry," Bronzini said, eyes bright. "There are dangers in the woods."
Matt went shopping for dinner, and then headed back to his mother's building, walking directly toward the western end of the zoo. Out over the trees he saw the residue of a jet contrail, the vapor losing its shape, beginning to spread and rib out. And he thought of the desert, of course, the weapons range and fly paths, and the way the condensation in the sky was the only sign of human endeavor as far as he could see. A city boy out camping, taking his soul struggle to the backcountry, and the Mach 2 booms came sky-clapping down, and the vapor formed an ice trail in the heavens. They were showing the tape again. The TV set was on in the empty room, and they had the tape going. They had the victim at the wheel, the random man, and the medium Dodge alive again in sunlight. They were running it one more time. Matt came in, surprised to find the TV on, and he sat on the footstool near the screen. When it was running, he could not turn away from it. When it wasn't running, he never thought about it. Then he'd get online at the supermarket back home, and there it was again on the monitors they'd installed to keep shoppers occupied at the checkout. 9 monitors, 10 monitors, all showing the tape. But this time, something was different. There was a voiceover, barely audible, and he looked around for the remote control device. He hit the button a couple of times, and the voice came up, and it had something in it that matched the tape. The voice was naked the way the tape was naked. A man's voice, flat and stripped, saying something about the weather. A set of words appeared, superimposed across the bottom of the tape. Live call-in voice of Texas Highway Killer. The voice was asking about the weather in Atlanta. They cut from the videotape to a live shot of a face above a desk, a woman with red hair and amazing green eyes, the anchor woman. The anchor woman was telling the caller that the weather desk said rain. Then she said, "And clearly this is not a true voice we are hearing over the phone lines. This is a manipulated voice, an altered voice." And the voice said, "Well, it is a device that disguises the sound. It is a device that's a little more than 3 inches by 2 inches, and you fit it to the talk part of the telephone, and it makes the sound hard to identify as an individual." Then she said, "Just to recap, we are taking a call from an individual who identifies himself as the Texas Highway Killer. He has given us information known only to the real killer and to the authorities, and we have checked this information with the authorities in order to verify the caller's credentials." Then she said something to the caller about his reason for calling. Matt looked at her, half mesmerized. Those eyes were an amazement, like offshore green you see from an airplane. The voice said, "Why I'm calling is to set the record straight. People write things and say things on air that I don't know from day one where they're coming from. I feel like my situation has been twisted in with the profiles of 100 other individuals in the crime computer. I keep hearing about low self-esteem. They keep harping about this. Use your own judgment, Sue-Ann. How does an individual with this kind of proven accuracy, where he hits targets in moving vehicles, where he's driving with one hand and firing a hand weapon with the other, and he's not supposed to be aware of his personal skills?" The anchor woman looked into the camera. She had no choice, of course. The camera was on her, not on the caller. She was a live body, and he was just a voice. Or not a voice, the odd sound, the devoicing, with contour and modulation strained out. Electronically toned, but not without a human quality, Matt thought, a trace of jerkwater swerve. The struggle to speak, the bare insides of the simplest utterance. The anchor woman listened. "I keep hearing about history of head trauma, whereby an individual, you know, can't control their behavior." They cut to the tape again. It showed the man at the wheel of the medium Dodge. "Let's set the record straight. I did not grow up with head trauma. I had a healthy, basically, type childhood." The car approaches briefly, then falls back. "Why are you doing it?"
"Say what?"
"Why are you committing these murders?"
"Let's just say it's a nice seasonal day where I'm located here, with scattered clouds. And if that's a hint to my location, then take it as a hint. And if this is all a game, then take it as a game."
On the screen, the man at the wheel does his little wave, the friendly, understated wave to the camera, and the future and all the watching world, his hand wagging stiffly from the top of the wheel. "You are aware, are you not, that one of these crimes is said to have been the work of a copycat killer? Can you comment on that for us?" Now here is where he gets it. Matt couldn't look at the tape without wanting to call out to Janet, "Hurry up, Janet, here it comes." Getting her mad. Mad at the tape and mad at him. And the more often they showed it, the more sing-song he put in his voice. "Hurry up, here it comes." An anxious joke. A joke in somebody else's voice, not meant to be funny. Janet swore at him and said, "Enough." But it wasn't enough. It was never enough.
Let's just say, okay, the police have their job, and I have mine.
The eeriness of the car that keeps on coming after the driver is shot. It approaches briefly, then falls back.
Which the correct term for this is not sniper, by the way. This is not an individual with a rifle working more or less long range. You're mobile here. You're moving. You want to get as close to the situation as humanly possible without bringing the two vehicles into contact, whereby a paint mark might result.
The car is drifting toward the guardrail now. The odd sound of the caller's voice, leveled out, with faint tremors at the edges, odd little electronic storms, like someone trying to make a human utterance out of itemized data. They cut to the face above the desk, the anchorwoman live. Her elbows rested on the desk now, hands tucked together beneath her chin. Matt wondered what this meant. Every shift of position meant a change in the state of the news. The green eyes peered from the screen, and the altered voice went on, talking in that flat-graft way. He was actually chatting now, confident, getting the feel of the medium, the format. And the anchorwoman listened because she had no choice, and everybody watched her as she listened. They were watching her in Murmansk, in a fog. The voice said, "I hope this talk has been conducive to understand the situation better. For me to request that I would only talk to Sue Ann Corcoran, one-on-one, that was intentional on my part. I saw the interview you did where you stated you'd like to keep your career, you know, ongoing, while you hopefully raise a family. And I feel like this is the thing whereby the superstation has the responsibility to keep the position open, okay? Because an individual should not be penalized for lifestyle-type choices." They began to run the tape again. It showed the man at the wheel of the medium Dodge. When his mother came in, he was scouring a frying pan with a short-handled brush. She stood there and looked at him. "You'll wear it out," she said. "I did this in the army. I liked doing it. It was the best thing about the army." "That was a long time ago. Besides, the pan is already clean. Whatever you think you're doing, you're not getting the pan any cleaner." "The TV was on when I walked in," he said. "You normally leave the TV on?" "Not normally. But if you say it was on, I guess it was on. Abnormally." "I always thought you were careful." "I'm pretty careful. I'm not a fanatic," she said. "You're wearing out the steel. You're clean right through it." He made dinner for them, and they kept a fan going because the air conditioner seemed to be running at half strength. "I walked over there today. Quite a few buildings are gone. Nothing in their place. Parking lots without cars. It's very strange to see this. There's a skyline suddenly." "I don't go over there," Rosemary said. "Good, don't. I don't like to go. I looked at 611. I don't want to see it." "No, you don't. Eat your asparagus," he said. He heard thunder in the west, the promise of rain on stifling nights, one of the primitive memories. "I caught Nick just before he left the hotel. Told him the doctor said you were in great shape. Don't get carried away. They'll send me printouts of all the tests." "Does he ever say anything to you? Nick? Does he ever say anything?" "No. Not to me either." "He erased it," Matt said. "I guess what else could he do? What else could he do? I don't know," she said. They ate quietly for a while. Two of the cats came out of the bedroom. They slipped past the chairs like liquid fur. "I went to see Mr. Bronzini." "Albert. He's the last rose of summer. I told him last time I saw him, see a barber. He goes out in his house slippers, I said to him. He lost weight. What did I say? You're turning into an old eccentric." They finished eating, and Matt went into the kitchen and got the fruit he'd bought, huge ruby grapes that did not have the seeds bred out of them, and peaches with leafy stems.
What time do you want me to wake you up?
Don't bother, he said.
What time is your plane?
When I get there.
You have your ticket all set?
I'm taking the shuttle.
The shuttle?
I don't need a ticket.
What's the shuttle?
I go to the airport, I get on the plane, and we go to Boston. Unless I get on the wrong plane, then we go to Washington.
Where was I when they stopped using tickets?
I pay on the plane.
What if all the seats are taken?
I get the next plane. It's the shuttle. One plane goes, there's another waiting.
Where was I when they did this? The shuttle. Everybody knows this but me.
He waited for her to say something about the enormous grapes bunched in the ceramic bowl, or to eat one, rinsed and glistening.
What about Arizona?
What about it? She said.
I don't know. What about it?
The last cat came out of the bedroom, the shy white one, and Matt scooped it onto his thigh.
Scrubbing pots and pans.
That was the best part of basic training, he said, because it was the most civilian part.
I don't know how many nights I stayed awake when they sent you over.
How many letters did I write saying I was nowhere near the combat zone?
You were in the country. That was near enough for me.
The country's not that small. If they fired a shot in Quezon, I wasn't about to get hit wherever I was sitting, comfortably indoors, doing my drudge work.
You were luckier than a lot of others.
You sure you don't want to go?
I'm staying here, she said.
They sat there with the fruit between them. He heard rain glancing off the windows, sounding cool and fresh, and he looked at his mother. She didn't see peaches with leafy stems as works of art.
I'm going to early mass.
Say hello to God for me. I'll have coffee waiting when you get back.
He erased it, she said, because what else was he supposed to do?
She said good night and went inside. The cats vanished while he made up the sofa. Nick was always the subject, ultimately. Every subject, ground down and sifted through, yielded a little Nicky. Or a version of the distant adult. Or the adolescent half-lout looking to hit someone. These were the terms of the kinship. He lay in the dark and listened to the rain. He felt little. He felt small and lost. His wife was little. He had undersized kids. They did nothing in the world that would ever be noticed. They were innocent. There was a curse of innocence that he carried with him. Against his brother, against the stature of danger and rage, he could only pose the fact of his secondness, his meek freedom from guilt. There was a noise near the door. He didn't move for a moment. He lay there listening. The rain hit hard now, splashy, rattling the window. He heard the noise again and got up. He put on his glasses and looked through the peephole. He edged the door slowly open. He looked into the hallway, long and prison-lit, left and right, rows of closed doors, all blank and still. And he was a grown man in his mother's house, afraid of noises in the hall.
This ends Disc 7.